Committee will come to order. Paul, go ahead and introduce our informational meeting.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, we have several things on our agenda today. The first is informational meeting from administration of the revenue system, an overview of that. We have Director Elizabeth Harchenko with us, and she tries to come and talk to the committees at the beginning of each session. So she'll go through the programs, of course, which is the major revenue collector for the state. At the end of the day, as much time as we have, Chris can continue on his overview of the corporate income tax. And then we do also have a couple of LC drafts at your spot there for potential bill introduction by the committee as committee bills.
Thank you. Ms. Harchenko.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Elizabeth Harchenko. I'm the director of your Department of Revenue, and I'm here today to talk to you about tax administration. And there's a big packet of stuff that starts, it's got a cover sheet on it called How a Law Becomes Reality, Making State Tax Policy Work. What I wanted to try and do as I talk to you today was to talk about what you do and how it affects what we do and how we try and make what you do work. So I'm going to give you a high-level overview of our responsibilities that have been assigned to us by the legislature over the years. I'm going to focus on our big tax program areas, income tax, tobacco taxes, property tax. I'm going to give you an idea of all the other things that we do also sort of briefly. And then what I'd like to do is take some examples of bills that were passed, three of them from last session and one of them from a little bit farther back, and talk to you about how the policy changes that you look at and recommend to the legislature for adoption, once they come to us, what we do with them and how we help taxpayers understand tax policy changes and what they need to do in order to, if they're eligible for something, claim it, or if they're required to do something, get it done appropriately. I chatted a little bit with Chair Barnhart yesterday, and he asked me to just highlight for you a few of the issues that we've seen and thought you probably would see and you probably actually have on your work plan already. And then I'd like to encourage you to ask me questions. Interrupt me whenever you think of something that you'd like to know, because I really want this to be something that's useful and valuable for you as you do the policy work that you do in this committee. So, the tour of the packet briefly. The top piece is a collection of material that's from our Ways and Means presentation. It's just to give you a taste of what we do. And then there are four packages, each of which has a colored page on the front that talk about four different pieces of legislation that we've implemented. And then I've given you a copy of our 2006 four-year resident booklet.
Thank you.
And that I will be referring to that to show you sort of how this all this process works. So starting out with our overview, which is the first packet. We consider it our responsibility to make tax systems work. And those we know and use as we talk to taxpayers that tax systems aren't in place just to be. They're there to fund services. And so we talk to people as we deal with them, especially in our collection work, about why they pay taxes, why it's important for them to do it correctly. Because education, public safety, and social services are the big recipients of the income tax money, particularly in the state. And as you know, that's the general fund that the legislature appropriates in order to provide services. So we try to emphasize that. And that's important to our staff as well. They know that what they're doing has an ultimate, very important purpose. We operate under four values. These were in the agency when I got there just under 10 years ago. And I'm sure that when I leave, they will still be there. It's very, very important for the public to have confidence in us. And so we emphasize honesty, integrity, and ethics with our staff constantly. We are always looking for ways to make those tax systems that we administered work better so that taxpayers can understand them, and it's simpler and faster and hopefully less expensive for them and less time-consuming for them to comply. We have to be sure that we are responsible to you for the financial resources that you give us in order to do the work that you've given us to do and process and account for the funds that we collect. We also have a responsibility with local government to make sure that, the property tax system and the levy system works appropriately. And then it's very, very important to us that we work with all of the people with whom we come into contact fairly and respectfully, whether that's taxpayers or it's other or business partners, you, the governor's office, and citizens generally. I've included our vision statement and a description of the strategic approach that we try to use as an agency. It's very important to us that people understand what their obligations are. We will never have, don't now and never will, and probably shouldn't, have so many people in the agency that we could stand over every taxpayer and tell them exactly what to do to comply with the income tax laws. So we rely very, very heavily on taxpayers to do what they're required to do under the law and initiate it themselves. And so it's important for us to educate them and help them to do that. We use enforcement tools when we need to, but we put a lot of emphasis on that education and assistance, and you'll see that as I talk about the legislation that we've recently implemented for you. We are in the knowledge business. We use a lot of technology, and so our staff has to be constantly learning and developing and maintaining their skills. And we try and use best practices, whether they come from the private sector or the public sector, from other states, or from other agencies in state government that are doing things that are related or similar. I've talked about the education assistance and enforcement. We call that our balanced approach, and we try to We use that. It may look different for the different programs, but fundamentally making sure that those systems are working well and people who want to try to comply can do so. I'm turning now to page 6. I'm going to talk about the income tax program just a little bit. We're responsible for administering both the individual income tax and our corporate income taxes, and that is a huge portion of your general fund. It's projected to be almost $12 billion over the next 2 years. And the processes and procedures that we engage in order to do that include education and assistance, as I said, but we process about 1,700,000 income tax returns in a year. We bank just over $5 billion a year. We have to review returns and make sure and refund claims and make sure that they're correct and accurate and that people are reporting the liability that they have correctly and validating claims for refund that they're also correct. If people have reported taxes that they owe but they haven't paid them, we have to work with them to get those payments. And we look for folks who should be reporting and filing but maybe aren't and get those folks into compliance and in the system. There are some environmental constraints under which we work, which is pretty typical, I would say, for a tax administration agency. We have to be very, very careful to maintain confidentiality of taxpayer information. Taxpayers entrust us with personal financial information. A lot of information they wouldn't share with their neighbors, they wouldn't share with their employers. They're only going to share it with somebody who has to have that information, and they need to trust that that is protected and confidential. So we place a high degree of importance on that. We, in order to share federal income tax information, which we also receive, we have to protect that federal data as well in our systems and as it's used by our employees. We have a lot of process that is in our law to make sure that whatever we're doing it correctly, we're doing it fairly, and that taxpayers have an opportunity to have any determination that we make review to be sure that it's correct. And we have internal process for that as well as outside review in the Oregon Tax Court. We get pretty specific statutory direction in the tax laws. If you've been in the legislature before or been around it and looked at the different kinds of laws that that different agencies administer, some of them you will see are kind of general. They're sort of more go forth and do good, figure out who needs to be eligible for this, establish standards of eligibility, and it's sort of broader policy direction. Tax policy direction tends to be very specific. And that's perfectly fine, because in the tax arena, you're drawing lines, establishing criteria, making sure that we have the instruction we need so that we can objectively and fairly administer the law. And another aspect of that is we don't have a lot of flexibility to make judgment or bend the rules, because I think the legislature recognizes that if people think that the tax laws are adjusted for people with different resources or different needs or different influence, that will break down the voluntary nature of compliance with the system. So we appreciate the fact that we get clear and complete guidance from the legislature on what you want done, and in some cases how you want it done. The next page just gives you an idea of where the dollars go from the income taxes. And this is something that we've tried to use as an education tool with the citizens, as well as here in the legislature. We've used this kind of information on the tax booklet periodically to let people know as they file their income taxes and pay their taxes, where those dollars are going. Any questions about the individual income tax?
Representative Gelser.
How has your enforcement personnel changed over time? Do you have about the same number of people in your enforcement department as you have in past bienniums? Is that growing? Is it decreasing?
Mr. Chair, Representative Gelser, it changes from over time. When I first started with the department, we were in a because of the economy that we were in, or at least starting in 2002, added quite a few people in the collection area and the audit area and filing enforcement. We had policy packages for several biennia that added people. This biennium, we've reduced the numbers somewhat, and we still have quite a few more than we did 10 years ago, 12 years ago. But we've adjusted our budget because of the use of technology and the amount of what we call services and supplies expenditures that we have to make. So we've had to hold some vacancy.
Can we do a follow-up?
Follow-up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do you have any data that shows the correlation, if there is a correlation between the number of people that are working in enforcement and the amount of revenue that generates? If you have people kind of policing that voluntary nature, does that increase the revenue that the state brings in? And by reducing the number of people, I would assume, in order to save money in a tough budget time, is there any correlation to the amount of revenue that's coming in?
Mr. Chair, Representative Gelser, there are many factors that affect the amount of revenue that comes into the state. One of the things that that we know is that 98% of the dollars that come in because people are sending them in on their own initiative. We impact about 2% of the total general fund amount of money that's coming in. We do keep track of our typical production by someone who's, say, doing collection work or someone who's doing audit work. And so if more people are doing that work, then their activities directly will affect or bring in a certain amount of revenue. But if the economy is doing something, it's going to swamp our efforts, whether it's going up or down. And so, for example, the revenues have increased over the last 2 years, even as we were not filling some of our enforcement positions. And while the economy was tanking in 2002 and 2003, although the staff we were given to generate dollars generated dollars, we could not overcome the effect of the economy on overall collections. So there are many influences on that. And what the other thing that we do, of course, is it's more challenging to measure what impact the front-end work that we do has on compliance. If we're out in the community and people are aware that they need to file, have the information readily at hand, we can make it understandable and easier for them to do, work with employers so that they understand their withholding obligation. That has an impact on that big 98% of voluntary medical that comes in, but it's very, very hard to measure exactly where and how what we're doing is affecting a particular amount of money.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Any other questions on income tax? It is a big system. I think I said 1,700,000 individual income tax returns. More than half of those during the last income tax filing season came in electronically. In the banking area, more than half of the money that comes in now comes in through electronic funds transfer, although there are still many more individual payments than there are payments through the electronic funds transfer system. The electronic systems do allow employers, particularly who are complying with the withholding requirements, to meet their time frame obligations after they meet payroll. Okay. The next big area for us is, and in terms of state taxes that we collect, are the cigarette tax and the other tobacco products tax. Under current law, the cigarette tax rate is $1.18 per pack of 20 cigarettes. And the tax on other kinds of tobacco products is 65% of their wholesale price. We collect the cigarette tax by pre-selling tax stamps to distributors, who then have to make sure that those stamps are on the cigarettes when the cigarettes get into the retail market. And we process payments and bank those payments and process returns that report the amount of other tobacco products that those distributors sell, and those are returns are done quarterly. We also are a partner in a task force with two other state agencies, the Department of State Police and the Department of Justice. And we handle the sort of the civil side of the house, making sure that we are collecting the tax that we should be, auditing when it's appropriate, and for cigarettes that are coming into the state that have not been taxed, making sure that we collect that tax. Our law enforcement partners focus on the criminal side, and when there is smuggling or other illegal activity related to cigarettes or other tobacco products, then they investigate and prosecute those crimes, and that partnership has been in place since 2003. The challenges that we have related to the cigarette tax include the fact that the rates vary a lot across the states. And in the joint session yesterday morning, I think Tim Nesbitt mentioned that we've got rates as low as 57 cents in Idaho, 80 cents in Nevada, 87 cents in California, and then over $2 in Washington State. So there's a wide variety of rates, and that tends to affect behavior, both in terms of people who are close to borders with states that have lower rates, maybe buying their product across state lines. And then some illegal activity is driven by the fact that people can purchase stamps or cigarettes stamped in a low-tax state and bring them in to Oregon and try to sell them here. So we are constantly working with our partners on trying to discover and prevent that kind of activity. The dollars that come in now are probably a third in relationship to revenue streams. Obviously, the income taxes is by far the largest, and between the lottery and the tobacco money, it kind of jockeys back and forth over the biennium. This biennium, under current law, it looks like we're right around the $500 million mark. The health plan gets most of that money. There are formulas in the statutes, because there's a little history on the next page of how the cigarette tax has developed in Oregon. And the way the statutes are structured, there's a 58-cent block that's distributed a particular way, and then there's a 60-cent block that's distributed another way. And as you know, the governor has proposed another 84.5-cent block to be distributed yet another way. We're a little anxious about being sure that we can bring in the revenue that is being projected to support the programs. So we've got also a
Mr. Chair, Representative
on the Olson. Ways and Means side.
You're concerned about that, and I have some concern with that too. So I'm kind of wanting to do a dual question, one to the chair and then also to Elizabeth. Are we planning on having the state police come in and talk to us about their process of ensuring, you know, trying to capture and enforce that, like what we did 2 years ago with mm-hmm. cigarettes?
That's a good idea.
We can certainly do that.
Because I know that there's a serious issue with that, too. So that's kind of where I was going.
I think that's an excellent suggestion. Okay. Yeah.
We have a large number of things to do this session, but I suspect we can find the time enough to listen to that. In previous sessions, of course, we had bills that were specifically aimed at dealing with enforcement. And I think that was the context in which those hearings were held. And I don't know whether we have any bills this time around enforcement or not. Do you know?
Mr. Chair, I do not know whether the Department of Justice has an enforcement bill in. There is a bill, Senate Bill 181, that I think Paul told me has been assigned to Senate Revenue, that extends the funding for the task force to come from the cigarette and other tobacco products revenues. Mm-hmm. When the task force was created, that funding mechanism was identified, and a sunset was put on the funding stream. And that sunset, the funding stream expires at the end of 2007. So there is a bill that would continue having the funding for the task force come from the taxes that the task force assures are coming in.
One presumes that when it finishes the Senate, if it passes there, it will come here. And that might be the time for us to have that conversation. Right.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to make sure that our understanding of what of the point you're trying to make is 100% clear. What Representative Olson is talking about is enforcement. Of course, that's an important element. Mm-hmm. Is that exactly, though, what you were referring to in your questions or misgivings about? I'm not trying to put words in your mouth, but I have the same suspicions, but they're not on the enforcement side necessarily. They're on the change of behavior side. And we're projecting that with this 84-cent per pack tax increase, we're going to get the same behavior of people buying cigarettes. I don't think that's the truth. I think we're going to get, and it might be a good thing, but we'll get lesser people buying cigarettes. Is that where you were going with that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bruin, partly yes. I actually was expressing anxiety that both of you have touched on. Governor's office did work with us as they tried to get a sense of how many dollars they ought to be able to rely on coming in, recognizing that there will be changes in consumer behavior. And I think that as your staff does the revenue impact, they'll talk about those issues of trying to predict not only what the effect of an increase in the price of the products would have on people's choices to whether or not to use them or how frequently to use them or whether to go to other sources for them. And all of that is you probably will be discussing as you discuss the governor's bill. Are the experiences that we've had over the last 4 years in the task force are that things never stay the same. We had done some work early in getting out and really letting retail sellers of tobacco products know that they needed to make sure that the products that they were selling were in compliance. And there was quite an impact when we went out and did that. And so that there was some behavior that changed that for the good in terms of compliance. As prices went up and as other factors in the economy that affect people's discretionary income occurred, and as internet sales started to get readily available and really popular, we saw quite a few people changing their source of product to a place that wasn't collecting our taxes for us. And so the Attorney General's office worked very hard with other attorneys general around the country to get some recognition on the part of Internet sellers that there was a federal law they needed to comply with, to report to the states if they were selling cigarettes into our state, then they weren't collecting our taxes, who they were selling to, so that we could go to those people and say, you know, you need to pay the tax. And to also, because there are some related laws here, underage selling to underage consumers, number one, and not collecting taxes when the state laws require payment of taxes, that the attorneys general were able to get some assistance from credit card companies and shipping companies to say to internet sellers, if you can't show us that you are collecting taxes, you aren't selling to minors, we're not going to ship, or we're not going to let you use our credit cards to take payments. And that really reduced the amount of internet sales. But that they did that on a voluntary basis. If they decide to change their behavior, there's that. And then predicting consumption changes, I think, is going to be something that your staff will talk to you about, how challenging that can be. So that's the concern that we have, is there's a reliance on a certain amount of dollars, but we probably won't know until after the law becomes effective, if it's approved, what actually is going to happen in consumer behavior or other factors that could affect people's choices.
Paul, did you have a comment on
that? I just follow up on what Elizabeth said. We've got Mazin talking about excise taxes on Tuesday, and he'll talk about kind of how we estimate. And we have a model we spend a lot of time on, including other states. But to kind of reinforce this behavioral reaction, we have noticed over the last year that cigarette revenue is running above trend. And one of the clear factors we attribute that to is Washington's rate increase to $2.02. So we're definitely getting some border effects as a result of that. We need Representative Butler here to talk about the Idaho border effects.
And presumably those Washington border effects will go away if the 84 cents is approved.
Exactly.
The idea being that's the amount of their tax.
Mm-hmm. If those two taxes are matched, obviously there's no incentive to come across the border and do that. we would lose that, whatever we've gained. And, of course, for us, the thing would be to try to estimate exactly what that is and how much of it is based on these other trends and how much of it is due to that Washington change.
It makes for a lot of fun for economists. Let me move on and talk about the property tax a little bit. The property tax funds local government, schools, counties, cities, special districts, some of them almost 100%, some of them quite a bit less. And the Department of Revenue, in partnership with local county assessors and tax collectors, helps to make sure that that system works. And so the roles that we have are what you see on page 10. We are the primary, primarily responsible for doing valuation for complicated, complex, valuable properties. So what we call our centrally assessed program, airlines, railroads, utility companies, communication companies, shipping companies. They're harder to value. The property crosses county lines, crosses state lines in many cases. And usually it's very, very hard for a local county assessor to get a good handle on the value. So the department does the value and then certifies to the counties how much of that value goes in what taxing districts within their county. We also provide valuation for industrial property used for everything from electronics to chemicals to food processing to wood products to other kinds of manufacturing operations, if their assessed value is $1 million or more. And once again, the theory being those are pretty complicated to value. They require specialized training and expertise. Some counties have the resources to be able to do that for themselves, but many do not. And so the legislature over the years has given us the responsibility to do those valuations. We also work with the counties on mapping, because to have an accurate property tax system, you've got to be able to describe the property. We actually perform mapping services for 14 of the counties. And for the rest, we establish standards and may do special projects when they need to remap an area because time is just passed and the maps they don't feel are as accurate as they should be. The other thing that we're doing in the mapping area, there's a special project that's been going on for about 8 years now called, we call ORMAP, and it's a digital statewide property tax map base that is available on the internet for the counties and for citizens and other people that need to use and want to use the maps. And we do that in collaboration with local government, the federal government, and we have an advisory group that includes both federal and local people as well as state people and folks from the private sector to help us with what the standards are. This is based on geographic or geospatial information system technology and has the capacity to support a lot of applications beyond the tax system. But since the tax maps are the most detailed, that seems to be what we call the base layer, and we're building, you can build on it with roads and rivers and emergency services management and bridge work and everything else. So it's a very, very exciting project, and it's really brought a lot of levels of government together on something that everyone can benefit from.
Okay. Questions on this segment?
I have one.
Mm-hmm.
You indicated that you're responsible for maintaining standards for assessment and mapping for the counties.
Yes.
A number of counties have substantial portions of their general fund budget paid for through the federal funds that we currently receive, but apparently, which have apparently been cut off for the future. An issue that counties have been raising with us individually and so forth. What is your responsibility, if any, for a situation that might arise if any of the counties are unable to maintain standards because of budget cuts?
Well, there's a provision in the law that the counties do have to meet certain standards, and there's a recognition. We've been talking with counties ever since it appeared that this might happen, although there's still a lot of effort to have the funds continue. What could we do to be of assistance? Because our statutes say that if a county fails to perform essential services in the property tax area, we're supposed to step in and make sure it happens. And we don't have the resources in our current budget to be able to do that for a number of counties. We are allowed to retain any revenue that is shared with a county in order to offset the cost of providing those services. But as we look at, and that would be alcohol and tobacco taxes, basically, but that probably wouldn't cover the cost of stepping in and doing their entire assessment and taxation function. So that was on my list of big issues. Let me just talk about it for a minute now.
Mm-hmm.
The governor's office is working with the Association of Oregon Counties to try to understand what the needs the counties have, not only from the revenue department, but from all of the agencies where there are big partnerships in program that are delivered partly by the county and partly by the state, or where there's revenue flow or standards, and asking them what they need, because each of the counties is going to have a different impact. Some that have no federal forest land are probably thanking their lucky stars they have no federal forest land. Others may have other sources of revenue, and this is not a major revenue stream. Yet others, it's a huge amount of money, and they're already starting to take steps to try to manage what they believe is going to be reduced resource. So there are short-term and long-term things that probably the counties will say they need. We're looking at what do we have the administrative authority to do in terms of if we could relax any standards, what would those be? What would be the most helpful? If there are things that we could pick up in partnership as a part of getting the property tax, keeping the property tax system running, what would those things be? How much could we reasonably do? What resources would we be able to shift within the organization in order to focus on what really is core in making sure that assessment and taxation process functions at the local level? So we're already trying to do that assessment, but we're we know that this is not something that each agency ought to do alone, that the state needs to be sitting down with our county partners and with cities and special districts who also would be affected if some of those core activities like assessment and taxation were affected in some counties, and figure out what are the counties able to do, what do they need from us, what would help them the most, and then what can we do administratively, what might take some shifting, and then what might we come back and say to the legislature, you may need to do these things so that we can support counties while they're adjusting to this or whatever happens. I do know the governor's office is still on full court press at the federal level to try and get funds restored or some of the funds continued. And we'll know more probably in another 60 days.
Well, thank you. So to summarize, it sounds as though it's possible that this issue may end up becoming a Revenue Committee responsibility in terms of dealing with local revenue, and it may become a Ways and Means responsibility in terms of dealing with your budget in order to accomplish these tasks.
Mr. Chair, I have a feeling that in order to try and address the issue, if the worst case situation occurs, which is that there are no funds at the beginning of the next federal fiscal year, that everybody's going to be engaged in trying to provide some ways to support the counties. There are business partners, they have been for a long, long time, and we've been talking to the assessors. What is it that you need? How can we help one another? How can some counties help other counties, which may also be an option? So we're looking at those things for property tax administration, and the governor's office is going to start, I believe, broadening this out so that as human services and education and all the other shared services that we have with the counties come into focus on, you know, what they think that they need to do.
Thank you. Other questions in this area? You have some more material.
I need to start moving through. The last couple pages of your packet there just shows you some of the other things that we do that you've assigned to us. A variety of other kinds of taxes, some of which go into the general fund, some of which are special purpose, and other tax administration activities that we engage in. We collect debts owed to other state agencies. We collect debts owed because of the operation of the court system. We collect transit taxes for Lane County and TriNet. And we have a couple of assistance programs that we run for you. One is a elderly rental assistance program where very, very low-income elderly apply for an assistance payment once a year, and that's funded by legislative appropriation. There's also what's called a funded property tax exemption for nonprofit homes for the elderly. We receive applications and then pay the equivalent of what the property taxes would have been on those homes if they had to pay them directly. And then we administer a senior and disabled deferral program for property taxes and special assessments. And that's a self-supporting program. The rest of my presentation was, okay, when you are through doing what you do, what do we do? And there are, I had four examples, and maybe I'll just sort of shorten this down a little bit and focus on two. There were a couple of bills that passed during the last legislative session related to military personnel as our involvement in the war in the Middle East increased, and more people from Oregon were called up, and the federal government was doing some changes in their tax code related to military personnel and compensation. The legislature decided to do the same thing. So as you look at the first two packets, the green packet and the blue packet, one of these is an income tax provision. The other one is a property tax. And I've included the bill, what it was intended to do, and then the things that we do to carry it out. So looking at the income tax, this was to provide some four things. First, we related to liability for taxes already owed, canceling taxes due if a service member died during active duty, and suspending tax collection action while they were on duty, providing an exemption for income earned while they were in a combat zone and for some military pay, and then adopting a federal tax exclusion for military death benefits. And The kinds of things we had to do in order to implement this, once you decided the policy that you wanted, was we had to change our collections practices, figure out how to identify people who we needed to stop collection action on, and getting that done. We had to change our income tax system, our computer system that checks over the returns to make sure that those are accurate, to recognize that this exclusion was now in place. It was made retroactive, and the statute of limitations for refunds was suspended for a period of time, so we had to get information put together so folks could apply for refunds of taxes that they had already paid. And in that packet, you'll see an information circular that we developed. We also needed to be sure that we were in compliance with some federal protections for people who are in the service, and those were also outlined in that. We use the Internet a lot to get information out to people. We do question and answer formats. We put our rules out on the web. All of our forms are available on the Internet, and people who are overseas can download whatever they need. And so this is the kind of effort that we go to try and let people know about changes in the law. We also educate people who prepare tax returns, accountants, and other tax professionals. We have to change the booklet. And if you look at that for your resident booklet that was at the bottom of your packet, the military information's on page 27. Talks about military active duty pay and the National Guard active duty pay subtractions. Gives people instructions of how to figure out whether they're eligible, where to go for more information. And we use news releases as well. And with the Oregon Military Department to try and get the word out to folks who are eligible. One of the challenges, I also listed some challenges that we faced. One of those was just making sure we were communicating with the folks that you were trying to help and their families. There had been a federal law change in 2004, particularly related to the death benefit. And Oregon's law was frozen at a lower death benefit. You weren't going to be here until 2005. But we had some people who were killed in action. So the governor actually asked us to communicate with those families and sort of put them in a special little place, hold those returns, not act on them if they went ahead and excluded the whole death benefit until you could act, because we had a feeling that you probably would pick that up pretty readily. So there are things that happen especially with groups. On the property tax side, we also saw House Bill 2945 last session that gave a $60,000 exclusion in terms of a property tax exemption for the first $60,000 of value of a person's home, service member's home. One of the interesting challenges that we ran into was because the application was due in April before the tax period for which the exclusion was applicable, and the person had to be serving during the tax year, was due some rules to try and bridge that gap. You couldn't apply in April if you hadn't served 178 days, but the 178-day service had to be during the taxable period for which you wanted the exclusion. So it was like catch-22. So we got some legal advice, and the lawyer said, you know, it's the way it's written, it doesn't work very well. And so we knew what the object was, and so we did come back and report this, and I understand there's some drafting being done to fix it. But sometimes in this case, a lot of bills got put together, I think, and pushed through fairly quickly, and amendments and things. And so sometimes we end up with something, and we say, all right, how are we going to make this work? And the property taxes particularly can be challenging sometimes when people have to apply for something. The other interesting thing about this one was if the qualifying military person wasn't here to make application or had been killed in action, a lawful occupant of their home could make the application. That wasn't defined, and so we had to do a rule to define who would fill that role. So I've given you a copy of the rules, and we often have to do rules that further explain what the legislature was trying to accomplish in legislation. And a couple of things from our website. We did quite a few news releases and other information to get the word out again. And then we developed a claim form that the counties could use, because folks had to file these claim forms with the counties in order for that exclusion to apply on their property tax assessment. So you can kind of see the steps we go through. Talk to the lawyers, make sure we understand what it is the law allows or requires. How can we make it work? Adopt our rules, forms, and instructions, and get the word out and provide information. Then another property tax law that passed last year or 2 years ago was Senate Bill 479. This one was with respect to the food processors, and we had a lot of conversations over the last several years with food processors about the property taxes that they were paying, because they're very capital intensive, and the economic competition that they were struggling with because of the global economy. If you go to the grocery store, you'll see fruit and vegetables from all over the world, and local food processors have really struggled in that competitive environment. So the end result was to give them an exemption for up to 5 years for machinery and equipment investments that they make, and we were given a partnership with the Department of Agriculture in order to carry that out. So the bill applied to new or used property that was new to the processor. It applied to machinery and equipment, whether it was considered real property, a fixed or movable personal property. And we entered into joint rulemaking and information with Department of Agriculture. So I've got some shots from their website and the rules that they adopted, and instructions and forms that we developed with them in order for the food processors to be able to take advantage of that exemption. The last one I want to talk about is a little more, shows you kind of some of the technical complexities that sometimes we end up with in some of the tax expenditures that the legislature wants to target to a very specific group of people. The Working Family Credit was first enacted in 1997, and in 2001 the legislature passed legislation to make it refundable beginning in 2003. We've never had a refundable income tax credit in Oregon, so this was new for the Department of Revenue. And I think we were challenged because there were two things we were trying to make sure happened. One, that people who were eligible under the rules adopted by the legislature could get that credit. And that that we made sure that the dollars weren't going out unless folks were entitled to them, because we have an obligation to protect the general fund. So we had to try to balance between how much are we going to do in terms of review of claims for these refundable credits in order to make sure that the general fund doesn't pay out dollars that shouldn't go out, but at the same time not hang people up in a whole lot of process, because the folks who were getting these credit really needed it. So we went through that process again. Legal advice, what are the boundaries, what have we been directed to do, what's the authority that we have, administrative rules, getting the new law incorporated into our systems. In this case, the criteria for eligibility were very precise and pretty technical. This parallels a federal credit. And so we had to make sure that we had information not only from the family or the parent that was claiming the credit for child care expenses, but also that the child was an eligible child, that the amount of money they were claiming was in fact what they had paid for child care, that their income level matched the criteria in the statute, because the credit is adjusted based upon their income level as a percent of the federal poverty level. So it's kind of a complex set of rules. And so if you look at your full year booklet again, at the back, the last three pages, are related to the Working Family Credit. And we try and help people understand who's eligible, based on the income requirements. What are the qualifying child care expenses that they're allowed to claim? The information they need to have about their child care provider. And then the form that they have to fill out. A lot of people who are eligible for this probably wouldn't be filing income tax returns. And so for some folks, all we would get would be the working family credit schedule. And this one has been a real challenge for us. There are, over the last 3 years since it became refundable, we've had about 33,000 people who've been eligible for the credit each year. And we've had, for 2005, we had about $22 million in refunds that we paid out. We adjusted about 10% of those returns and reduced claimed refunds by almost $6 million as not substantiated or things that people weren't eligible for. And so it's that's been a real challenge, and we have actually even a request down the hall for some additional resources in order to be able to work those more quickly so that people can get their refunds more quickly. That one has been really very, very interesting for us. The rules, we had to go into, you know, who gets to claim the credit if you have parents who are separated or divorced with joint custody and both of them are paying some child care. So it has been quite a challenge for us. And we have done a lot of outreach. The last three pages in that packet that you have are brochures that we developed focused to parents, child care providers, and tax preparers so that they would understand the credit better and be better able to help to claim it accurately and have the information they needed in order to verify how much they were eligible to receive. So that's kind of how we take what you've done and try and make that work. Sometimes we're good at it, and sometimes it's challenging for us. I did list for you the issues that you're going to see for sure, and Paul has probably already spoken to you about, connection with any changes in the federal tax laws, tax expenditures. We worked with the Governor's Office and Department of Administrative Services and prepare the annual tax expenditure report, or biennial, the tax expenditure report that came out at the same time as the Governor's budget. And I've heard some folks talking about looking at those again and how effective they are. I know you'll be talking about tax compliance and enforcement issues. There was a lot of discussion about that last legislative session, and I think it's coming back. The funding for the property tax system we talked about just a bit because of the federal forest dollars that are at risk right now. We talked a little bit about tobacco, and we'll be glad to, by the way, Mr. Chair, happy to bring our business partners in when you're ready to talk about the task force and how that works, bring the state police and Department of Justice to come talk to you about how we work together and the issues that they see on the law enforcement side. If you just, Paul can just let us know. And then you heard yesterday, again, from Governor's staff about the tobacco tax increase that the Governor's proposing and the corporate minimum tax change. One other thing I didn't get on this list, but that is something that we have been hearing about recently, is as counties are looking at the possible loss of those funds and looking for other sources of funding, we've had a number of phone calls about local income taxes. And you've probably seen that locally. We've had inquiries from Lane County and Jackson County and even Curry County about local income taxes. There was as you know, Multnomah County had a temporary income tax a little while ago. And we had had conversations about whether the department could assist in implementation and administration. We have found that because our system is so big and that we need to deal with large numbers of taxpayers, that for us to pick up and efficiently be able to administer a local tax. It needs to piggyback very, very closely on something we already do. And I don't know whether you're going to have approaches from the counties about enabling additional tax resources. But that would be, if you do start talking about that, that would be one of the things that for us would be really important for us to be able to help, would be some parameters that would indicate if, you know, if they want to piggyback, it needs to be able to just really fold right into the existing system and not have very different structures about who the taxpayers are and tax rates and exemptions and what income's taxed and that sort of thing. We administered a business income tax for Multnomah County for years that very closely paralleled the corporate tax. And it was easy for us to do because it was so close. And the taxes we collect for the transit districts parallel very, very closely our withholding system and the estimated tax system. And so folks can report withholding and their TriMeter Lane Transit payroll tax calculating using the same base. So that's something that if we can help, it's going to take that kind of that parallel, and I wanted to just let you know about that. Are there any other thoughts or questions folks have about any
Representative
Sure, if I may. Thank you very much. Can I back you up just for a minute to the, and I don't want to get too detailed here because I know this is a broad overview, but I want to go back just for a sec for a moment to the your discussion on the working family child tax credit.
Mm-hmm.
And I agree, just you know, what a convoluted mess. And my question to you is, I guess my point is that every family that has kids, regardless of their income bracket or what they do, is a working family, just by definition. And I thought this is such a strange instrument, such a complex instrument. Wouldn't it be better if we somehow found an exemption for everybody with kids and had it just not have some sort of means test or working test or anything like that, and or change the standard deduction? And that leads to my question to you, which is, it's hard for me to get my arm around exactly what that is for what we're doing for children. I know I have to look at the standard deductions, and I think that's all there is. And I know that changes every year based on CPI, I assume, or something like that. But I just, if you can give me the 15-second how we're taking care of families with kids right now, forgetting about things like the working family tax credit.
Okay, I think I'm going to defer to your staff on what all happens in the tax system that's related to children, because what I was prepared to talk about today is sort of how we implement
it. Okay, I realize it might have been
rather than the policy piece. But one of the issues that this does raise is when you choose, when you're approving policy and you do have a policy you want to effectuate, whether it's making sure that people have the resources to provide child care for their children so that they can work and kids are well supervised, or some other objective. When you are doing it in the tax laws, you're making a decision about what's the best way to accomplish the policy objective. You can spend money down the hall at the other end of the building, or you can spend money this way. And what I think we're learning as we go through the Working Family Credit and talking with the Department of Human Services, who works with folks who are eligible and who were intended to get the benefit of this credit, we had to learn an awful lot about people that we hadn't worked with before. And we've brought income tax administration values and processes into the system. And I know from personal experience that there were a lot of folks who got very frustrated by that and needed money. I mean, we heard from a lot of people who said, you know, I'm counting on this refund in order to pay the rent. And now what you want is you want records from my child care provider, and you want this and you want that. And so as you think about using tax expenditures, and particularly refundable credits, think about whether we're the right delivery system for it and whether people are going to get what you want them to get in the way you want them to get it. There's another refundable credit coming. I think it's related to mobile home park closures. And because of the fact that it's a credit on an income tax return, somebody could find out they have to move in January 2007 and not see any money until March or April of 2008. So I would ask that as you think about these things, you think about, are we the right delivery mechanism? And there were some things I would hope that you would ask us as you go through your process of policy development. We've tried to work with the legislature over the years as sort of an augmentation to your staff. You have a wonderful staff, and they're fabulous to work with, and we've had a great working relationship with them, and they feel free to ask us for help on administrative issues and data and everything else. And we hope that you'll consider us to be kind of like volunteer staff, too. We aren't going to tell you whether we think the policy is good or bad. That's your job. What we're going to try to do is tell you what we can about, if you approve this, what we think we understand you're trying to do, how we would try to carry it out, and what the impacts on taxpayers might be, that we can imagine, at least as we talk to you about policy sort of in the abstract. And so I hope as you talk with Deborah Buchanan and John Phillips about tax legislation that we might be administering, that you'll ask those kinds of questions. You know, is this something you can administer the way it's written? Are we being clear enough? Do you understand what we're asking you to do? What might you do to carry this out? Is there something, if this doesn't sound simple, is there something we can change to make it a little simpler for taxpayers to be able to use and benefit from? And that's the way I think we can help you the best. So I really appreciate the time to talk with you. If you have other questions now or later, either send me an email, give me a call, ask Deborah or John, and we'll just do everything we can to get the answer.
Great. Thank you. Other questions? Representative Rosenbaum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And not a question, but just a comment, that it's hard for me to not comment on the working family child care credit, because I just have to mention, and I think Representative Barnhart will remember this because he was here that session, that this was a very hard-fought policy that the chair at the time of the Revenue Committee, Lane Chatterley, and I were co-chief sponsors of, and we really worked long and hard to the very waning days of the 2001 session to get this policy through. And in fact, it really is crafted to target tax relief at the very lowest of low-income tax, well, not tax filers, but people who wouldn't even be filing a return. And so I think if you look at it over time, it really has done a lot to put money back into the economy and into the pockets of people who are struggling to get by. And if you look at the end of it, you will see that it was, over my objections, tied to a much, much larger tax break for businesses in this state. So I think those policies are ones that had a lot of thought that went into them, and was really quite a proud achievement that session. And I applaud the department for all the efforts they have made to make it work.
Can Representative Brown?
Yeah, and I thank you, Representative. And I certainly didn't mean to, looking back at exactly how the words came out of my mouth, wasn't how I implied it. I know there's hard work and lots of thought. My only point was we have a lot of families in Oregon, and working families regardless of their income level. And so my idea was more of a broader look. Should we be looking at ways to perhaps, given our status quo level right now, should we be looking at ways to help families in Oregon with children even at a larger level? So, I didn't mean any disparagement whatsoever, and my hat's off to you for it.
Thanks.
And, of course, the director was simply pointing out the complexities of administering this statute, and we appreciate very much your bringing these issues to us. As you were talking earlier, it occurred to me that as I practiced psychology for a number of years, every quarter or maybe every month, I don't remember, I filled out a form to send to your agency along with a check for a variety of taxes. And my recollection is that it was a one-page form which allowed me to pay the Lane Transit District tax, the income withholding, and two or three other things, probably an employment tax and maybe some other things, very conveniently. And for a guy who was very busy doing other things, it was still possible for me to do that by hand. I think that it's important, as we do our work, to recognize that employers need to
fill out these documents and need to be able to do it and need to be able to do it quickly and easily and write the check for the correct amount so that this whole system functions. And most employers are not a whole lot bigger than I was, I think, in Oregon. Thank you. Other questions or comments? Thank you very much.
Thank
we
you.
Appreciate the presentation very much. And I think that I would like to go out of order a little bit so that we know how long we can allow for the continuation of our corporate income tax review and open a work session for possible bill introduction. So let's do that now. Paul, would you tell us about the drafts that we have in front of us?
Okay. Mr. Chair, you have two drafts, LCs in front of you for a bill introduction as committee bills. The first one is LC 1509. This is an increase in the corporate minimum tax. It comes from the work of the interim Senate Commission on Education Excellence. It was part of their overall plan and included an enhancement of the school improvement fund and a number of other elements to try to improve the efficiencies of the K-12 system. Of course, from they could not introduce this particular bill on the Senate side, so that's why they have asked you to introduce this as a revenue committee bill at the request of the commission. So that's how the bill would be printed, as a House Revenue Committee bill at the request of the Senate Commission on Education Excellence.
Okay. Before we begin our conversation on the bill, on these drafts, let me just say that it's been our custom, especially for the new members, it's been our custom to consider introduction of bills as committee bills without regard to anybody's long-term plans for the bill. Voting in favor of introducing a bill does not commit you to support the bill later or even imply that you might support the bill later, simply a way of getting the bill before the legislature. In fact, it's quite possible that we might introduce a bill or two that end up in another committee and that we never see it again unless it gets to the floor. With that, do we have a motion?
Mr. Chair, I move the submission of LC 1509 as a committee bill.
At the request of
who is it?
The Senate Commission on Education.
The Senate, at the request of the Senate Committee on Excellence.
Thank you. Representative Berger moves that we introduce LC 1509 at the request of the Senate Commission on Education Excellence. Discussion? Any further discussion? Are there any objections to that motion? If not, the motion is adopted. Next. Thank you, Representative Berger. Next draft.
Mr. Chair, the next one is LC 1832. This comes to the committee really based on some work in progress from Representatives McPherson and Butler, who it's designed to revisit some of the issues around Senate Bill 408. And you recall that was approved last session by the legislature and signed by the governor. That was a way to try to get at the PUC's method of handling state and federal income taxes for purposes of determining rates for utility use. So this is trying to get at some of the legal issues that the two representatives thought were still kind of remaining after the passage of Senate Bill 408.
Discussion, what's your pleasure? Representative Berger.
Mr. Chair, I move the admission of LC 1832 as a committee bill.
Discussion? Representative Berger moves LC 1832 as a committee bill. Any objections? Hearing none, so ordered. We'll close the work session on bill introduction. Paul.
Mr. Chair, we have Chris back with us, and he's been waiting in the wings and to finish our discussion on corporate income taxes.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Olson.
Questions we get started here.
Yes.
Chris has brought to my attention from my colleague to my immediate right. Do we have any sound effects today?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I apologize. I have not added any sound effects. I don't know what the appropriate sound effects would be for the corporate income tax.
We can help you. We're creative.
Become one of the with Moles and
Grove. Yeah, Moles and Grove.
It would have been a long, low moan.
You aren't very good. No question about that.
Well, as is the case with many other tax issues, it may be eye glazing, but it's still very important.
It is.
Okay, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. If you recall, yesterday we talked about just some terms, and we talked about tax liability briefly. The remainder of the presentation are four sections: tax collections. I have a few slides on tax collections. Then a couple of issues. One is apportionment, and then to tax credits. And then I wanted to wrap up today with a discussion on business taxation in general. Just have a few slides there to kind of prompt that discussion. The first slide I wanted to show is a history of corporate tax collections, in part to represent the magnitude and the volatility over time. So from fiscal 82 through fiscal 06 is what's contained in this chart. And we see actually throughout the 80s, it was relatively flat and slow growing. But once we hit the 90s, we had a lot of growth and a lot of volatility. And one of the differences there is that it became dominated by the manufacturing sector. And recently, and here we see that fall in 01 that we're all too familiar with, and since then there's been some strong growth in that sector. This chart just shows the annual changes over time, and it's a different way of looking at the volatility of corp collections. The blue line, it represents the annual average over this time period, and it's about 7 or 8%, but as the red bars indicate, it rarely lands on that average. It's either far above, as in 80 or 94 and 04, where collections grew by 30 to 40%, or in 01, 02, where they fell by nearly 50%. This chart is from some sector data that the Department of Revenue puts out, and it provides a nice snapshot of the number of C corporate taxpayers and the amount of tax that they pay. These are the 12 months ending November 2006, so they're almost the most recent. This information is put out monthly. We can see that the payment amount, the largest sectors there are wholesale trade and retail trade. Finance is number three, and manufacturing has fallen in this time period to the fourth largest in terms of tax payments. On the employment side, construction and professional scientific and technical services dominate the scene there. Next, I wanted to show just four charts. This is similar to the withholding charts that I showed on Wednesday for selected sectors within the corporate tax. And the point here is I wanted all four of the charts on the same page just to see the relative trends and how they vary across the sectors. The time period is November 2000 to November 2006. And we see that wholesale trade didn't come through very well. It's about $60 million. It was flat and has grown over the past couple of years. Retail trade was flat throughout the recession, and then just until 05 started picking up again, and as consumer demand picked up. Finance insurance had a little more volatility over that time period and ranged between $40 and $80 million on an annual basis. And the last one I wanted to show is manufacturing. And this one has really been up and down. A couple things I wanted to point out. All the charts are the same magnitude. They're all on the same scales this time, from $0 to $140 million. And one thing about viewing the data in the moving totals way is that any large payments or refunds that occur in a given month kind of stay in that 12-month slot, so will appear in the chart for a year. So, for example, what we're seeing here in manufacturing, the payments picked up, but then what may have happened here in November 2004 is that there was a large refund that went out, and that kept the amount of those payments down for 12 months, and then once that those large refunds in that 1 month leave this 12-month total, it spikes back up. So it's a little, that's just a caveat to keep in mind when looking at data for the 12-month moving totals.
So these are cash in numbers, net cash in numbers. They're not related to how much the business is actually owed in taxes.
Mr. Chair, that's correct.
Okay, thank you.
Here's a chart. I was trying to stay away from too many numbers on the screen, but I wanted to put up this table that shows the four main sectors and their annual change for the past 6 years in dollar terms and in percentage terms. Now, the sectors were chosen. We have the four largest sectors, and they're sorted in that order. So we have wholesale trade, finance, insurance, retail, and manufacturing. And this is the magnitude of their share of receipts that they represented in fiscal year 06, which is the most completed fiscal year. So for all of the collections, the dollars in the door received in fiscal year 2006, so that's July 05 to June 06, the wholesale trade companies contributed 22% of that amount. And we can see a couple things. So once you get to the fourth largest information, their share falls to 6%. So the top four take the lion's share of the collections. So the variability I wanted to point out here is that in the wholesale trade in fiscal 02, wholesale sector payments or collections by the state fell by 30%, and over this time period they grew as much as 78% in fiscal 05. Finance and insurance fell by 50% in fiscal 02, and then the next year they grew by 97%. And then following that 97%, they grew by 63%. Retail trade is by far the most stable within this group, but still over the past couple of years, there's been strong growth there. A lot of that is coming out of the recession. Manufacturing has been the most up and down. We have, going into fiscal 02, a decline in 84%, then another slight decline in 03, but then a growth of 379%. Followed by a decline of 65%, and then growth of 147% in the payments in those fiscal years. And this, again, it's dollars in the door, so it's a mishmash of when the corporations file their tax returns and when they pay up their liability. Throughout the year, they'll be making estimated payments, and then they'll file their return, and they may get large refunds. So that's something to consider in understanding the volatility here. And this chart, again, is similar to some of the information I showed on the personal income tax collections. And the idea here is just to give a perspective of how we look at collections data, both our office, legislative revenue, as well as the state economist. We'll look at it for understanding the impact on policy change. For any policy change, we'll look at a tax year and understand the change in the liability that policy would cause. And then the next step is to see how that might change collections, which results in the fiscal year impacts that you see. The state economist, and I believe they're scheduled to be here next week, and they'll talk more about this. They look at this information, understand, to forecast the revenues coming in. But I have a couple slides here, one for tax year 2004, and the next one will be for tax year 2001. And so one of the primary things is the difference in those 2 years. 2004 is a fairly typical year to the extent that a typical year exists. If every year looked like this, then it would make our jobs incredibly easy. So there, with that in mind, a couple things I wanted to point out here. The receipts come in over a much longer period than on the personal side. On the personal side, virtually everybody, if not everyone, has a fiscal year that is the calendar year. It's January to December. And so within that year, the withholding payments come in, and then 6 months later through the filing season, so the 18 months from the start of the tax year until 6 months after it, we have a pretty solid picture of what revenues are. or what the collections were, and liability. On the corporate side, taxpayers can choose their fiscal year, and that can start in January, it can start in December. And so that stretches out the time period for which we see the collections. One difference between the PIC collections, if you'll remember, and the corp collections here is that up until through the first two years, it's all positive. All the payments are coming in, and they're positive amounts. And again, this is just for a given tax year. Once the taxpayers start settling up their returns, they're getting refunds. And a driver behind that is the late payment penalties on the corporate side are very stiff. So corporations always overpay. They want to avoid those penalties. So if we look at and here we see that when they file their returns, while the fiscal years vary a lot, roughly 80% or so of the returns are calendar year filers, and they represent about 60% of the tax. And so we see this bump right here, if you will, are all those people filing and settling up their return in November. So for 04, they had the calendar year 04 was their tax return. Their initial return was due in March or April of 05. Corporations generally file for extensions as a matter of course, and then the payments are settled up in November. So here, this spike, if you will, reaches 13 or 14%. In 2001, it reached to over 25%. And so again, the situation throughout 01 didn't look radically different from prior years. We have the spikes for the estimated payments. The magnitudes were different. But then once the returns came in, the refunds going out were even greater. So where are we right now? 2006, this is the information that we have so far. Again, it's fairly typical pattern. And so the question moving forward will be, what is this pattern going to look like? And if I may, one thing I wanted to point out here relates to the corporate kicker. The corporate kicker for 05-07 that's projected right now, if you can look at this graph and view this, pretend this is tax year 07, and this is the fairly typical pattern for the corporate 07 liability. Once we hit the end of the biennium, we'll know how much corporate revenues exceeded the forecast, assuming everything stays the same. And that amount will be, the state economist will certify that amount in September of 07. Then to determine the kicker percentage, they take that amount and divide it by their forecast for the estimated liability for tax year 2007. And so if we view this whole area as that collection stream for tax year 2007, this is the amount of information that they have in hand on which to base that estimate. The rest of this is the estimate. So it's much later in the cycle than on the personal side. On the personal side, because it's a refund check, and when it's done, the Department of Revenue knows what the liabilities are, so the amount going out is a much better calculation, a more accurate calculation.
Now, suppose that you used an earlier year as a measuring year. Rather than 07, you used 06. Then we'd be looking at that line being just to the left of the question mark, wouldn't we?
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
And so you'd be able to make a much more accurate estimate, one presumes, at that point of what the base is against which the refund is being made.
That's correct, Mr. Chair. Much more and better information will be known by that point.
All right. Other questions? Thank you. Go ahead.
Okay, I wanted to move on to multi-state apportionment. This has been a hot topic the past couple of sessions, and last session we went to a single sales factor apportionment. So I just want to provide some background and revisit that topic. Within the multi-state, the multi-state apportionment applies to only companies that operate in more than one state, and each state is only allowed to tax the income that can be attributed to their state. So the apportionment is simply a method by which that income is determined. And 40 states have a corporate income tax. 10 of them have an equally weighted formula, and I'll get to some details on what these formulas are, but they're based on three factors: property, payroll, and sales. 16 use a double-weighted sales, and these are for tax year 2006. 7 of them have a super sales factor, if you will, where the sales factor is between 50% and 90%. And six, including Oregon, has a 100% sales factor. And the other eight states have a hybrid system where they rely on a couple of formulas. They, for example, the base for many sectors, it might be a double-weighted sales factor, but for manufacturing, it might be a 100% sales factor. And of these seven, three or four of them, I believe, are phasing in a single sales factor. And anywhere between by 2008 and 2014, I think, there will be four more states that are currently scheduled to go to 100% sales factor. A brief history on Oregon's apportionment formula. Up through the 80s, it was an equally weighted formula where sales, property, and payroll each accounted for one-third of the apportionment formula. And that was fairly common. Most of the states at the time had an equally weighted formula. Throughout the in 1991, that was changed. And throughout the 90s, we had a double-weighted sales factor. And then in 03, we went to a super sales factor. And that was scheduled to become a single sales factor over time. But then last session, we went to a single sales factor by the end of that session. Plus the multi-state corporations, and in 2004, about 21% of all corporations were multi-state, just to provide a sense of how many corporations this affects. And that's roughly 12,000 C corporations and 5,600 S corporations. Now, the C corporations are affected directly and we see that effect on the corporate income tax side. For the S corporations, they're still subject to the apportionment formula. And then that affects, and it actually flows through to the personal income tax side by affecting where the income is sourced for the shareholders of the S corporations. There are three exceptions to the single sales factor. Oh, and I should mention on the number of states that use the different formulas, that was their main formula. There are a number of states that have slight exceptions, but that was the main formula used. Our exceptions are that insurance companies use an equally weighted formula. Utilities and telecoms are allowed to use a double-weighted sale, so presumably they'll calculate their tax both ways and use the formula that results in the lower tax. And then certain wood products corporations are required to use the double-weighted sales factor. But that's just a handful of companies. There are about 1,000 insurance companies, but those are the exceptions to the single sales factor. And again, to provide some context for the number of corporations that this affects, in 2004 there are 83,000 corporations, this is C and S, and their liability for 2004 was $311 million. Now if we start subtracting some companies that aren't affected by this, which is what I'm going to be doing here, we get to a number, a much smaller number. First, if we pull out the Oregon-only companies, that's 66,000 companies, and they pay a tax. Their total liability was about $42 million. And then less the multi-state insurance companies, because they use the single sales, or the equally weighted formula, that's another 1,000 companies that aren't affected. Total liability of $32 million. And the multi-state S corporations I put in here, because they don't really, there's not as big impact on the corporate tax, because the corporate tax that they pay is the minimum tax. And then pulling out the multi-state C corporations that paid the minimum tax in 2004, that was 6,500, we get down to about 4,200 corporations in 2004 that were affected by this, but they accounted for about almost two-thirds of the tax liability. Here's an example, and this is mainly for the new folks. So, if past members, if you'll bear with me for a minute, I just want to walk through this quickly. So, these factors are defined a little bit. Here we have a multi-state corporation that operates in two states, Oregon and California, and their payroll. They have $12 million of payroll in Oregon and $28 million of payroll in California, for a total payroll of $40 million. So their payroll factors are 30% in Oregon, which is the 12% divided by 12 million divided by 40 million, and then 70% in California, 28 divided by 40. They have $20 million of property in Oregon, $30 million of property in California, total property of $50 million. And their sales, their $100 million in sales, 20 of it is in Oregon and 80 of it is in California. So these factors are determined. You have a payroll, property, and sales factor for Oregon and California, totaling to 100%. And their average, in this example, this is just a straight average, so this would have applied in the 80s, is 30, and that's the average of 30, 40, and 20. And California is 70. So if they have a net income of $5 million, that $5 million is multiplied by Oregon's apportionment percentage, 30%, and arriving at $1.5 million of income that's taxed in Oregon. And then the 70% times the $5 million is California's share. And so the $1.5 million is multiplied by our tax rate to get their pre-credit liability. To see how the impact, the effect that the single sales factor can have on corporations is the point of this slide. Because it can increase or decrease the amount of liability of a corporation. Here we have two companies, Company A and Company B, and they have their Oregon factors are listed here. They each have 30% of their payroll in Oregon, 40% of their property in Oregon. Company A has 20% of their sales in Oregon, while Company B has 50% of their sales in Oregon. And under the double-weighted sales formula, Company A's apportionment percentage is 27.5%, and that is simply the average of the payroll, 30, property, 40, and then two sales, so a 20 and a 20, gives kind of a four-factor formula, and that average is 27.5. Company B, under the double-weighted sales factor, their apportionment percentage is 42.5. Going to 100%, a 100% sales factor, Company A, we simply take this sales factor here, so their sales factor is 20%, a decline from 27.5, and Company B, we take their 50%, so their apportionment actually increases. So Company A, if they're $5 million of net income under the double sales, their taxable, their income subject to tax is nearly $1.4 million, but under single sales it falls to $1 million. And for Company B, under the double sales factor, their $2.1 million of income is subject to tax. Under single sales, it increases to $2.5 million. So that's conceptually how it works. And I have a couple of slides that show how that different distributions of how the impact on the liability changes. These numbers are represent the blue is actual liability from 2004, and the red or this purple, dark purple bar is what the liability would have been had single sales factor been the case. And we can see here that the largest gain in terms of net is the large companies over $25 million of income had the biggest drop. Everything else were slight changes. The $5 million to $10 million companies actually had a slight increase in liability due to the single sales factor. Here's a chart that just shows the companies whose tax liability increased, led by agriculture, they had the largest, the 12% increase, going down to those who had their liability reduced. Manufacturing was cut by 50%. The thing that's missing from here is the magnitude of these sectors, because not all of these sectors are the same size, and entertainment and mining are quite small. So here's a chart that provide some sense of the magnitude of the sectors. And here again, we can see manufacturing having that 50% decline, and wholesale and retail trade, the liability there actually increasing under the single sales factor.
Was farming on that list?
Mr. Chair, agriculture didn't make it on here. Every sector on here would be very small, so I just put the largest of the sectors on here. Oh, I apologize. It's there on the bottom.
Oh, there it is. Okay.
Mining didn't make it on the list. Entertainment didn't make it on the list. Not that I have anything against those sectors. They're just small.
Thank you. So.
Here, don't be blinded by all of the numbers here. I just want to point out a couple things. In the yellow bar there, this is, again, it's a simulation run. It's kind of an average of simulations run on tax years 1999 through 2004. And the point here is to provide a sense in a so-called typical year the number of companies that had increases or decreases under the single sales factor. So in total, under the all category, there were 2,500 companies that had a tax increase, and their average increase was $34 million. There were 1,500 companies that had a tax reduction, and their average reduction was $79 million. So in very broad terms, two-thirds of the companies that were affected by the single sales factor actually had tax increases, but they had relatively small tax increases. And the one-third of companies that had a tax reduction had much larger tax reductions. So that's where the net reduction in liability occurs. The other thing I wanted to point out about this is that I tried to divide it into sectors. This column here are the number of companies and dollars. I left off the M here. I apologize. These are millions of dollars. These are those companies that had a tax increase, and we can see that they span all sectors. And that these columns are those that had a tax reduction, and it again spans all columns. The top row here is where the sectors that had a negative net change, whereas down here they're the sectors that had a positive net change from going to the single sales factor.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Rosenbaum.
Thank you. Chris, do you know, is the single sales factor evaluated in the tax expenditure report?
Mr. Chair, Representative Rosenbaum, it is in the current tax expenditure report. It's in the 0709 tax expenditure report. There are actually, if I may, a little history on that. There have been five or six tax expenditure reports, and it has not been in a tax expenditure report up until this time. This is the first time it's made it into the report. It is in there. It's a little, there are some nuances about whether or not it should be in there, and I think it was put in there this time mainly because of the interest in the single sales factor. There are two other tax expenditures related to apportionment percentage. I mentioned them earlier, the telecoms and the wood products manufacturing. The tricky thing about whether something is or isn't a tax expenditure is the notion of what is the normal tax base, because the statute doesn't say this is a tax expenditure per se. It defines tax expenditure in one area as a deviation from a normal tax base. And under the single sales factor, apportioning income to a state is a little tricky in terms of what is normal, what is the proper base. One could argue that the normal way to do that, or the normal base, is an equally weighted sales factor. That was the case for the 80s and I think even the 70s. For many years, there was an agreement called UDIPA, Uniform Division of Income Tax for Tax Purposes Act. I'm sorry, I get used to the acronyms and I forget what they stand for.
I have exactly the opposite problem. Go ahead.
And for a number of years, so that's the question. You have these multi-state corporations, and how do you tax them without double taxing them in different states? I mean, it's a tricky kind of situation where all of the states each want to tax the corporations for the privilege of doing business in their state and for the benefits that the state provides the corporation. And so the question is, how is that income divided among the 50 states? So for many years, it was an equally weighted formula. One could argue that that is the normal base, and that any deviation from that should be a tax expenditure, and there are people who argue that. From that perspective, the double-weighted sales factor should have been a tax expenditure and should have been in that report all along. That would be one perspective. A couple things that make it a little bit cloudy is that, in general, tax expenditures reduce liability for people or for companies. A credit, it reduces liability, so it's unambiguous. Here, as we're seeing, here's a single sales factor that increases liability for more corporations than it reduces tax. So that way of viewing it doesn't really fit with the general notion of what a tax expenditure is.
And I'm sorry, follow up, Mr.
Follow
Chair.
Up, yeah.
So, but the tax expenditure report is supposed to be evaluating these policies for whether they're fulfilling whatever purpose they were created to meet. Do you know what it says? I guess I can look it up myself, but Because it's never been clear to me what the policy was that this was meant to be encouraging.
Mr. Chair, Representative Rosenbaum, I believe the argument for it is that it would reduce, as an economic development tool, in that it would reduce the liability for manufacturing, and we've seen that it does that, because those are companies that have large property and payroll, but sales go elsewhere. So we bring a lot of the production into the state. The idea is that we lower the tax burden here. It encourages businesses that are manufacturing intensive, which are generally higher wage jobs than service sector businesses. I think that was generally the argument for going to this. In the tax expenditure report, I actually can't remember offhand what it says in the evaluation. I believe it was sent to the Economic and Community Development Department. The wording of the tax expenditure, it kind of describes that there's some question about whether or not it is a tax expenditure for some of the reasons that I've touched on here, as well as some other technical reasons. I mean, it's a large discussion, and we can talk about that for quite a while, but I don't think we can if you...
Other questions on this topic? I have an observation, I think, and you can tell me if it's really a question and I've got it wrong. And that is that, serendipitously, depending upon the formulas that different states use, a corporation might have all of its income accounted for in the various places where it does business, may have more than all of its income accounted for in the places where it does business, or may not have all of the income that it has accounted for in the various places it does business, depending almost serendipitously on the formulas that the different states use to calculate their apportionment. Is that an accurate statement or
Mr.
not?
Chair, that is accurate. And I had another example of where that laid it out, but I was concerned that things were getting... I was doing too many examples there, but that is a correct observation.
So another observation is the uniform agreement that you referred to that used to be in effect really did apportion all of the income for every multi-state corporation because every state calculated the formula, the apportionment the same way. Assuming they all use the uniform agreement.
Mr. Chair, I believe so. I don't know offhand if every state did abide by that. The vast majority of them did. And that, in short, the point of that was to ensure that in no state, so that the point was that each corporation's just 100% of their income was taxed by the states, not more, not less. But as we saw a couple slides ago, there is this variation across the states. And even within states, there's variation across sectors.
Thank you.
Sure. Okay. Credits is the next topic. Are there any more questions on apportionment? I'll try to go pretty quickly here. The credits used here for over the past 10 years has varied from year to year, but has ranged from low 20 million to high 40 million. But it does vary. This one shows that in any given year, not all of the credits are used. The light blue bar shows the amount used, and I need to learn what the color is. Purple those are the unused credits. So the bars represent 100% of the credits, and more often than not, over half of the credits go unused in any given year. Here's a simple pie chart of the major credits that are used. Pollution control, research, and business energy, energy conservation are the main ones that are used. And here are...
Representative Berger.
Yeah. The share of credits used... now, some of these credits can be carried over. Is that...
Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, that's correct. There are... I'm sorry.
Yeah, and the question then is, in the tax expenditure report, when they're put in a dollar amount, it's for the full credit whether it's taken or not. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, no, it's meant to be the amount that will actually reduce liabilities.
Okay.
And it's a very tricky thing because you have some corporations, in a real sense, you have corporations, a handful of corporations that are using some of these credits, and whether or not the credit will reduce liability depends on whether or not that corporation will have profits in these upcoming years. And so I guess a better answer is that it's a kind of an average expectation of what will be used and what not.
Expectation is it?
Yes.
Word. Okay.
Yes.
That helps.
Mm-hmm. The carry forwards vary. The pollution control credit has a 3-year carry forward. The research has a 5-year carry forward, and the energy conservation has an 8-year carry forward. And that simply means unused credits get to be carried forward to offset tax liability in subsequent tax years. And here's a chart that shows the trend in the unused credits, and we can see that the majority in recent years of the unused credits are the research credits, where currently in 2004, $30 million of unused research credits exist. And that's a combination. They're kind of rolled up each year so that whatever credits aren't used in 2001 were rolled over to 2002 and subsequent years. And they either eventually get used by the corporations to offset liability or they expire.
Questions? Go ahead.
Okay. Should I continue?
Let me inquire. Are there other committee meetings that people have to get to today?
Mm-hmm.
Well, then I think we're going to wrap up then and ask you to come back for business income taxation, which of course is the most scintillating of all the topics that you've covered thus far. That will be good. We'll be prepared on Monday to also look at the. Overview, is it overview of the property tax system?
Correct.
So come prepared to talk about property tax. We appreciate everyone's careful attention through the session today. Thank you very much for making a difficult and obtuse topic more transparent.
Welcome.
Thank you. And the Revenue Committee is adjourned.